claimed to be part of the Society of American Baseball Research Oral History. With this, let me begin. My name is Mark Collis. I'll be interviewing Joe Mueller today, and the date is August 11th, 2016. Joe, starting out, the first question I wanted to ask, I know that that you signed for a considerable bonus, and then you remember the Dodgers when you were 19. Did you ever anticipate that you would be a member of the team that quickly?
After the first year I had, to start out when I first signed with them, but, because I kind of knew the process and, a lot of guys spent some time in the minor leagues. But after my first year in the minor leagues when I was 29, I felt confident enough that I could make the club, and I had, an outstanding spring, and then the guys kind of had, it was a make or break down in San Diego against the Braves. And I just struck out 5 out of the 6 that I faced. And so, I felt like I definitely earned a spot. If anything, they were going to, if I even, stumbled a little bit, then there was no reason to keep me. So I really had to show enough to make the ball club.
Okay. I know that your fastball was your best pitch. What were some of the other pitches that you threw?
Well, and actually my curveball, they compared it at that time. I think I'd read a few, that I had a curveball second to Kovacs's, which was really my best pitch in the minor leagues. I worked on a changeup, but at that time I just had trouble, connecting with it, and that would have been the pitch that would have definitely turned my career even, to a different direction.
Okay. I know that you had some troubles with control problems, particularly in those first couple years. What were some of the advice or approaches that Joe Becker used to help you address those problems?
Well, and it's interesting, because my first year in the minor leagues, I'm an addict through high school minor leagues my first year, I think in 237 innings, I think I walked, I had 67 hitters or 70 hitters, and so I had outstanding control. And, at that time, especially as young as I was when I went to the, spring training and everything, people were trying to change my delivery, and, it wouldn't even happen nowadays. But everybody kind of wanted to grab on to what looked like was going to be, a successful career and everything. And so guys would try and make changes, and so, and I was so eager at, 19 years old to listen to everybody, and if anything, it was a real fault, because it was like, if they don't fix it, it's not broken, and everybody was trying to fix something, so I think that I stumbled, and then finally, I got it back a little bit after that.
Was it different coaches, or did some of your teammates help you with that? Did they get involved with that, I guess?
Yeah, just anybody that came along, from minor league, people and things. And I don't blame anybody, I'm the one that listened to them and tried to, be eager to try and learn. I mean, here I was in a big league camp, which was, a dream for everybody, but intimidated or overwhelmed, and so anybody that made a suggestion, everything from teammates, to let's say minor league coaches or whatever, that I knew their names,
Okay. Next question, and it kind of goes back to the first one, but I try to ask this a little different way. Did you feel, I guess if you look back now, do you feel that maybe you were rushed along a little too much, that if you had had maybe a couple more years of minor league seasoning before you came up, that you might have been more successful right at the get-go?
Not really, and I'll tell you why, because the changes, I did some things that were maybe a little bit unorthodox when I, that I did in the minor leagues the year before. I mean, I would warm up, 6 feet further than the 60 feet, 6 inches, 6 to 9, 6 feet probably further, and I would do that. I would do a lot of long catch, which I felt, you know, strengthened my arm. And then when I got up to the major leagues, you know, came up to major league camp, it made me stop doing all those things. And so I just think that the way I pitched in the minor leagues with the, you know, outstanding control I had, and, you know, that if I would have been just left alone, I could have carried that on through. In other words, I had the stuff to do it. It was just that, you know, with the changes which affected my control, and that was the biggest thing. So, no, I think I would have been just fine if they would have let me do what I had done to be successful in the first place. And today, they, you know, because I was with the Marlins for, you know, 16 years until I just retired, that is their policy is don't fix it, don't try and make a 300 hitter into a 320 hitter, or don't, you know, make a pitcher that is successful, don't try and change them to be even more successful.
Okay. This is where I guess I'm going to reference David Platt's book now. In his book, it mentions that because of your age and the bonus, that you felt a certain amount of isolation from the rest of the team when you first came up. Can you talk about that a little bit, your first year, and, you know, you being 19 and, you know, being kind of the young guy with a bonus?
Yeah, and it was totally understandable then. You know, here I, you know, with the combination of the money that I got from my brother, and then also was given my brother and my dad, you know, where, you know, it was like, I think it was like $90,000 total. And so for a lot of those players, I mean, you know, I would think that Snyder and all those guys were making much more than $30,000 to $40,000 at tops, you know, until Drysdale and Kovacs held out. And, you know, especially those guys that played in Brooklyn, you know, for how little bit. Well, my first year in the major leagues, I made $6,500, you know, pitching for the Dodgers as a poor starter. So I didn't understand it maybe less at that time, but, you know, I didn't think about it. I just, you know, I got that money. So, but I could feel the resentment easily. I mean, I was one of the first players to have his own room. You know, we always had roommates because no one wanted a room with me. Well, besides being, you know, 19 years old, I didn't drink, I was a Christian, you know, it made it very difficult. There was no question there was resentment. I mean, it voted me a half a share, even though I was only gone 30 days, you know, and I was 6-5 and pitched 100 innings, and they voted me a half a share of them, you know, what would have been the World Series money for playoff money. So there was definitely, you know, on the road, you know, I knew there was a team party, you know, different cities. You know, I was never invited to those. So, yeah, I was totally isolated. And then Leo Durocher was, and I've mentioned this many times, and it was, in fact, Tommy Davis, the one that stuck up for me, which I didn't know until just recently, to tell Leo to leave me alone. Because every time I'd walk out of the dugout before a game, Leo would, you know, he'd be asking, hey, you kid, you want to go can you get a drink tonight? And he said, oh, no, you can't because you only drink milkshakes. You know, and then you got all the reporters to laugh, and, you know, and that was constant.
Right. I get back to that in a minute, but I know in Michael Lane's book it mentioned about the voting you a half share. I know he kind of goes into that in the book about you know, the Snyder was kind of led that. I mean, did anybody in the locker room speak up for you at that point about the unfairness of that?
No, not at all. It was like, I don't want to say quietly done. They just, you could just sense it. You know, it wasn't outwardly blatant other than Leo, you know, that just not like the fact that I was with that, you know, with the ball club, and he would do it in a way to entertain the sports writers, but he never did it, you know, said anything to me. You know, like, you don't deserve to be here, you know, and whatever. What also hurt me that first year, too, is because we were on a four-man rotation, Kovacs, Drysdale, and Padres, myself. And so, because then they had, usually had an off day, either on a Monday, on a Thursday, or a Thursday, and so they would skip my spot in the rotation, you know, with the off day, and, you know, and so I would go, you know, sometimes, so like 8 days before I pitch sometimes. That really hurt, you know, because it was understandable, too, you know, you get those other guys back, you know, pitching every fourth day, and they would skip my spot because of the off day.
Okay. In your time with the Dodgers, what managers or coaches or teammates influenced you the most?
It's interesting because, I think they kind of assigned him to me. Was Carol Behringer, our bullpen coach, you know, nicest guy in the world. He but he kind of took me under his wing. They had him room with me a couple times, you know, just to have a roommate, I think. And Norm Sherry was a super guy. Boy, you know, just couldn't have been better to me. And they usually had him catch me because, you know, he definitely handled, I think, young pitchers. And, you know, John was, Roseboro was good, great, too. I love pitching to him. But I think for some reason they wanted Sherry to catch me more.
Okay. Who are some of your favorite teammates, and are you close with anybody in particular still?
Jeff Torber was, you know, we became close friends. He joined the club, I think it must have been 66, that's first year, 64. Anyways, he, you know, just a class guy, solid Christian guy. We roomed together, Don Sutton and I roomed together, still very close friends. Let me think of anybody else. There's Jimmy LeFevre. I grew up with him, and so when he joined the ball club, you know, we watched the room together a little bit. Yeah, there were a lot of guys that I, you know, were like you. And Renee Lachman was our bat boy my first year in 62, and we were only 2 years apart in age. So actually, I kind of, you know, was closer to him than the players.
In your 8 years with the Dodgers, can you talk about one or two of your most memorable games?
Pitching in the World Series, I give up one run in the two innings I pitch, but, you know, that's every pitcher's dream, or any player's dream, because there's a lot of guys that are in the Hall of Fame, you know, I think Ernie Banks and Randall Wins, you know, that never got to play in a World Series. So I think, you know, like pitching that World Series in 66 was absolutely, I didn't think I'd get in any games because, you know, we had Kovacs, Drysdale, Osteen, and Sutton, and I was the fifth starter, but I just picked the doubleheaders. And then in the bullpen, we had one of the best bullpens in history of baseball with Phil Regan, Bob Miller, Jim Brewer, you know. And so I just thought, hey, I was going to just enjoy a World Series, and then, you know, Drysdale got in trouble in the first game, and I got a chance to pitch in it. So that was easily, the best game, for me. That was the game that sticks out the most.
Okay. Any memorable or colorful teammates that you remember you always kind of, you know, have to smile about?
There's always, every club has somebody like that. You know, Jim Brewer for us in the bullpen. Was a funny guy. Rick Phil Regan, great guy. You know, I had a lot of good teammates, but that was later, you know, actually when I was more established and a little older, too, you know, so that I fit in more with those guys. Were the first year, those were guys that had gone through some tough times, didn't make any money, you know, much money. Most guys had a job during the off season. I mean, I worked at, I think it was white front stores, and got any other jobs just to make ends meet. So,
clearly DeRocher and Alston were different personality types with very different managerial perspectives. I saw a quote from you that was in David Plott's book, actually, remarking that there were two camps, and one that sided with Alston and the other that sided with Leo. Can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, was there a kind of a venomous type of thing? Not so much against the player against player, but more against, if Leo was managing, if we would have done this instead.
Yeah, there was no question. And again, there's like three groups going up. There was two groups and then myself, you know, especially that in 62, because I was none of the, you know, guys was I included with anything, but I'd be standing there, and then there'd be, was it Daryl Spencer, Andy Carey, Lee Walls, the guys that weren't playing, and they'd be down at one end of the dugout, and Leo would come down, and how can he do that? How can he make that move? I can't believe he did that. You know, he was undermining the ball club. He wanted that job. I mean, that would have been perfect for Leo, who's, you know, wasn't married to Lorraine Day, and he was with the Hollywood crowd, and friends, close friends with Sinatra and Joey Bishop and all those, Sammy Davis Jr., and so he was close to those guys, so he would have loved to manage that Dodger ball club. So, you know, I was kind of like an outsider, you know, in that dugout, but I could see, even as a young kid, I could see that he was trying to, you know, make the turn the club against Alston and, you know, the players to hopefully get him fired. There's actually no question in my mind.
Did any of the players that was supporting Alston ever, did you ever see any of them kind of say, Leo, knock it off, you know, it's, you know, this isn't helping the team?
No, not back then. I mean, I don't, not at all. I don't think there was anybody that stood up for him. Because there were some of the regular players, too, that maybe disagreed with, you know, like any ball club, you're going to disagree with the manager what he does sometimes. You know, you're not going to all be in agreement, but Brochure was just stirring it up. I mean, he was, you know, just totally trying to undermine Alston. They wanted his job.
I know that, you know, I mean, I know you touched on this a little bit already when you talked about some of the comments that he made. I mean, in general, he has a lack of kind of faith in younger players, and it kind of comes out in the book. And this was one of the things that I really, you know, kind of struck me from reading Michael Leahy's book is, you know, all the things I've read about him as the manager with the Cubs. You know, it was like, okay, this was all on the table before he ever took over the Cubs job, because you see this constantly, in the years that he managed the Cubs. Is there any other, you know, stories, I mean, as far as you were concerned, that, I mean, where, like, he treated you or maybe some of the other younger players with is not as much respect?
I just thought this is the way it was. I don't think I even realized what he was doing at the time. You know, because I'm more of definitely an introvert, and so I just kind of stayed away from him, just kind of didn't say much. I stayed at the end of the dugout, you know, other than seeing when he would come down and how he would talk to the other players when, you know, he disagreed with something that went on. And Alston was so quiet. And, you know, a person anyway, he was totally opposite of Leo. But, I mean, he knew what was going on. He knew that Leo wanted this job. I mean, you could tell that was, you know, almost a given. But, you know, Buzzy wanted Leo there with the ball club. That sure wasn't, you know, not like today when the manager picks his coaches, you know, with maybe a section of one or something. But, boy, not then. You could see, you know, that they were not on the same page.
Yeah, I remember, that was kind of my next question, is I know that, you know, read obviously a lot about what happened, and Plus book goes into this obviously a lot more than Michael Leahy's book does, but the whole, you know, blow up at the end of the 62 playoffs, and the fact that, you know, my understanding is Babazie actually fired Leo, and then for whatever reason, Alston somehow talked him back into it. I don't know. But supposedly he was fired, and then he wasn't fired. And I guess my question here is, was there any change in the relationship after he came back in 63?
You know, I wasn't with the ball club in 63. You know, I was sent to the minor league. Although, and I'm not sure if that had anything to do with it, because I had just an outstanding spring.
Right, well, even in spring training that year, I mean, they kind of like went their separate ways at the end of the 62 season, and there was this, you know, understanding that Leo got fired, and then he got rehired somehow. When you came to camp in 63, was there more, what was the, if you could remember, what was kind of the feeling at that point?
Yeah, but see, I don't know that I remember that. Because when I was running spring training, I was just trying to win a job, so I wasn't concerned about Leo or, whatever their feud was. And so I honestly don't remember, what was going on at that time. I probably was a little bit surprised, that was hard for me to believe that Wolf wanted him back, the way things are. But Buzzy pretty much controlled, everything. So that had to be a Buzzy thing for me. I can't imagine Walt would have, encouraged him to come back.
Okay. Kind of the last question on this, and again, I know you've read Michael's book, and clearly his premise here is with regard to Leo is that, his treatment of some of the younger players, in 63 and 64, hurt him, to the point where people all got kind of tired of Leo's shtick at some point, and that was really the reason he wasn't invited back. I know he tells some stories about, Leo and Frank Howard and Leo and Jeff Torborg. I mean, did you see anything like that in, say, 64 even, that kind of showed that as well, that people are just kind of tired of Leo's act?
Yeah, and I think the players, and finally, there's no question that then the players, it's like anybody, you just finally get tired of hearing him undermine things and whatever, and even some of the guys, I think, that were on his bandwagon, and the guys that were on, that were close to him were just guys that weren't playing, and so then they were not happy about not playing, and so they jumped up, and that's where he gravitated towards, because he knew he had those guys, and he'd be telling him, hey, you should be playing. If I was managing this club, you'd be playing. And so, that's the guys he gathered around him. But there were I do remember that story about when, how Leo would tap Howard's shins, and put all the riders around and make a dance. And boy, that time when he came out and Leo did that, Frank was in no mood. And there wasn't a nicer, more gentle giant than Frank. Boy, he should not have done it that day. And I could have kissed him for what he did, because that's what I wanted to do. To just grab him
You mentioned Jeff, that you were friends with Jeff Torborg, and I know the story in the book about Torborg kind of knocking him out when he tried to take, knock the ball out of his glove, kind of the exercise he was doing with Pete Reeser. Let me preface this by saying, I talked with Dick Kaczynski. I haven't interviewed Dick Kaczynski yet, but I did talk with him on the phone, and we had probably maybe a 10-minute kind of conversation. I was kind of giving him, what I was kind of looking for. And I mentioned this story because I said, well, you probably, he's so, covered in the book so much, I thought he had probably read the book by then, and he hadn't read it yet, but I mentioned the Torborg story kind of as an example, and he kind of discounted that, said, no, that never could have happened. He said, I'll have to go back and read the book, but that never would have happened. Do you have any patience?
Which one, the Torborg knocking the ball out of his glove?
The story is that he was working out with Pete Reeser to, keep the ball in his glove. And DeRozier came along and said, I can knock the ball out of your glove anytime. And he does all these warm-ups and gets all, warmed up. And they set bases up, and he comes running around the bases. And Torborg lays the ball on his head. Didn't mean to do it, but it didn't sound like he meant to do it anyway. But he lays the ball on his head and knocks Leo cold. And there are other players around, and they're kind of giggling, at the whole thing.
I didn't see that, but it would surprise me, extremely surprise me that Torborg wouldn't say that if it didn't happen. I just know him. He's way too much character to just make up this story. And I know that Jeff did not care for DeRozier. Again, young player. And just the way that know, that Leo is so boisterous and put on such a show and would put down players and, you know, to make himself look good. And you know, there was, I think there's quite a few players that would have liked to have been in that situation, you know, to do that to Leo.
Okay. Okay. I have one last question, and this one is totally off of topic, and it's I got this because I noticed in your Sabre bio that you have worked with some teams in developing computer programs graphically tracking players' tendencies. And I'm assuming that this is the kind of modeling they're using now for the development of all the shifts that we're seeing, you know, in every day in the major leagues. Can you talk a little bit about some of the work you've been doing in that and how that has kind of carried over and kind of what may be going on in the majors now?
It's interesting because when I see Sutton every once in a while, he'll say, that, you know, he says, you were so far ahead of your time. You know, how it started was Don McMahon was the Dodgers' scout. And it had to be in the early 80s, you know, maybe 83, 84, or somewhere in there. And I was at the game, and he had a heart attack in the dugout and died. And I thought, oh, well, I would love to. I've always been fascinated by, even when I played, you know, with statistics and you know, setting up defenses and things like that. And so I thought, well, I'd love to do that job. So I went, and I think a couple of days, I went down to the dugout, and I went to the clubhouse. I wanted to see how they were doing it now. And they had stacks of notebooks. I mean, they covered the whole wall, and, you know, about starting guys. And I remember we charted, you know, I was sitting behind the home plate the night before I pitched and chart, but just how they collected the information and then what they did with it. And I thought, oh, there's got to be a better way to do this. And this is when computers weren't fashionable,
right?
Just coming in. And so I went to a computer, I searched around, found a computer major at USC, I think it was. I don't know who led me to him. And we talked, and I ended up spending about $100,000 of my own money, which I really didn't have. Had him develop a program with, if I was an advanced guy, what kind of information would be helpful? And so, you know, he did the program and started taking it around to different clubs. I remember Alcon Dennis, I showed it to him, and he said, Joe, he said, at 19, whatever, 48 or 9 or whatever it was, he said, we won the pennant, and we didn't have a computer. Why do we need one now? But that was the mindset of baseball at that time. I mean, you know, they were so intimidated by computers and just, you know, they've been doing it one way for so long that, you know, we don't need this, you know, this garbage. And then Jeff Torberg, you know, became the manager of the White Sox, and, you know, he was on board with it. So I sold it to the White Sox, then I sold it to the Padres, I sold it to the Mets, and to the White Sox, I sold it for $100,000. And I think it was 70 or 80 to the Mets and something the same. So, and then Bob Boone, we were friends. We played together actually a little bit. And I showed it to him. He's a Stanford graduate and, you know, very aggressive on things like that. So I let him use the program. And so, but it still took quite a while after that for, you know, and I kept working on it and improving it. And, of course, technology got better. And now, you know, that's clubs do 10 times that now, and there's software programs that, you know, cost 1/100 of what I, and, you know, I had to pay to develop my program. So, and then, you know, I'm a believer in there's a combination of not only statistics and all those things they do, you've got to have scouts out there. You know, you've got to, because when I was advancing, I would find out information about, you know, the guy, he just got hit by a pitch on his wrist. He's not turning on the inside pitch. That's not going to show up in, you know, your analytics and things like that. So, and then also, who's taking the information? I mean, what is it? Stats, Inc. They just have somebody that could be just a high school baseball player and, you know, saying, okay, that slider rolling away and different pitches. And I'm not taking it away from them, you know, that they don't know their baseball, but there's a certain amount that Renee Latchman told me, he said, I would rather have no information than wrong information. So, it's interesting. interesting to me. I'm not involved with baseball at all now. I'm enjoying my retirement. But it's interesting to me, just like to watching how aggressive the shifts have gotten. And, you know, I just like to see some, you know, how many times the shift has worked and doesn't work. I mean, are there numbers to show that, well, yeah, they did a shift and they caught this ball, but how many times did they do the shift and it didn't work, you know, when they when it went through the hole where a guy would, you know, would be? So.
Yeah, I wonder now if what this will eventually create is kind of at the you know, amateur level and in the minor leagues, you know, having people become more, you know, hit the ball field than they are right now. I'm wondering if that's going to, you know, that'll be kind of the, okay, it's gone this way, and now there'll be the reaction to that.
That's a good point. You know, they're going to be teaching hitters that, you know, you can't fit into that shift. You know, what's working, but are you taking away that you know, that I was thinking Inside Edge is the company that, in fact, I had 9 different managers with the Marlins and Joe Girardi, and I went to spring training and 1 year, and I said, Joe, I'm your advanced scout, and he said, oh, really? Okay, nice to meet you. And he walked away. And you see, Joe was a huge, he loves Inside Edge. He lives and breathes Inside Edge. He could care less, at least he did with me, you know, having an advanced scout. So he loves, you know, the statistics, the numbers only.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting because I'll confess I am a Yankee fan, so I follow Girardi quite a bit, but I know he said a few weeks ago he was advocating, and I didn't see it personally, I kind of heard a report, so I don't know how, if he was joking, but he would like to make the shifts illegal. You know, but it seemed out of place, and maybe he's just frustrated because of the way they're hitting this year, and they've got a lot of older players that basically are going to do a throwaway no matter what. And maybe he's just frustrated, or maybe he was being sarcastic, but it seemed like kind of odd from what I've heard of him, and, you know, kind of being a forward thinker generally.
Yeah, because he wasn't with me. Boy, he just was, you know, and like I've said about, there's things I use with Inside Edge, but at the same time, I want to know who's putting that information in, because I've been in the press box with people, and they're talking away, and oh, that was a curveball, isn't it? And then, you know, so, what kind of information are you getting to say, okay, they're throwing, you know, with a count, when you're behind on the count, you're using a breaking ball, and you're not using a breaking ball, and this count, and things like that, you know, but how accurate, you know, is that accurate?
Right. I mean, you have to have somebody that's really paying attention to the game to be putting that information in and make it real.
Yeah. There's a lot of things for it. I mean, you know, somebody asked me the other day talking about how the difference in the players, you know, in the 50s and 60s and back then compared to today. And I said, you know, in spring training, I think it was in the early 60s, they used to tell us not to drink too much water, you know, when it was 100 degrees out, because you'll get cramps or Buzzy Gervais said he'd find me if he ever caught me, heard I was lifting weights again. You know, and yeah. They have, you know, the finest weight rooms in their clubhouses than anybody. So they have to be better. The conditioning, the nutrition, you know, all the things that have come about in the last 20 years, let's say, that players have to be better.
Yep, absolutely. Well, again, I think I'm done here, and I thank you again for, you know, your time today. I will send you a transcript of this, and I'll send you a memory stick once I get that done. It may be a few weeks. I'm supposed to do an interview with Stan Williams in the next couple of days, and I still have to catch up with Dick Trzuski yet. So, I'm going to try to get all of those and do them all at once and then get them all together and then get them to Sable.
Okay.
All right?
You'll get, from those two guys, you'll get definitely different viewpoints because of where they were at. You know, Stan was a veteran and Trixie was a veteran too. and both good guys too, Tracy especially. Well, he was as well liked on our club as anybody. Him and Sandy were really, really close, but he was, you know, one of the most popular guys on our ball club too. So, yeah, look forward to it.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Good luck to you too. Thanks.
All right. Have a good day.
Good. Bye.
Bye.